Hello, and welcome to episode 441 of the Crate and Crowbar, Scotland Special. I'm Jamie Britton, and I am not Scottish, but I like to think I am. Joining me today is Chris Thurston.
Hi, definitely not Scottish.
And special guest star, Paul Canavan. Hello, Paul.
Hello, I'm from Edinburgh, so I'm kind of Scottish.
Good, that checks out. So I think what we wanted to do is get Paul on, because Paul, well, why don't you introduce yourself, Paul, for people who don't know who you are and what you do?
Yes, okay. I'm friend of pod Paul Canavan.
He really is.
it's me in the flesh, in your ears. I'm an artist and I guess a game designer now, which is strange to say. But yeah, you might know me from games like Magic the Gathering and D&D and Silent Hill Townfall, which you haven't played yet, but you might one day, and Destiny 2 and Guild Wars 2 and stuff. And I just kickstarted my first game, Pale Tides, which is a folk horror role-playing game. That's me. That's my whole story.
Fantastic. And we'll be, as we have been for the last few weeks, we'll be sticking a link for that in the show notes. Can people still give you money for that, or is that all done now?
Well, I don't think so, because I think I messed something up. They were supposed to be able to. Okay. But I can't help but notice that that's not happening, and I think that's because I broke it. So no, but you can certainly look it up and look at the Kickstarter page and go, oh, that looks nice.
And if people sort of see you in the street, can they just like give you a tenner or something? Just hand it over.
I mean, absolutely, yeah. If you see me wandering the streets of Edinburgh, please give me £10. Thank you.
Good, and I would like to just plus one on that. If anyone sees me around, feel free to give me £10. Yeah, it's just a general policy there, I think. So since you were on, I thought we could talk a little bit about Scotland. There's a couple of Scottish games that have come out in the last year or so, which I thought might be worth talking about, namely Still Wakes the Deep and Judero, which we'll get to both of those. Well, I wanted to get your take generally on like Scotland as a game location, because it's a weird one, right? I can't think of many good examples of Scotland in games, right? It's like, there's like a version of it which is like the Uncharted Hitman, like big country house type thing. And then like footage missing. Like, I don't really know how else Scotland ever kind of, you know, feeds into these things.
Yeah, I feel sort of quite intense pressure to represent my entire country here. but that's fine. It's an interesting one. I mean, Scotland in games is, it's either sort of comic relief, as in like fantasy games, like you're kind of, I don't know, World of Warcraft, where everyone who's Scottish is also just talking like this the whole time. Or it's like that kind of American perception of Scotland, which is basically what you're talking about. Like, it's Braveheart or the Untouched Wilderness. It's a little bit tokenistic. There's usually kind of no actual consultancy, I guess, going into those productions, particularly, especially for Braveheart. Yeah, I don't know. It's a weird one. It's a big question. I can't think of many games that do it well. Still Wakes the Deep is definitely one.
It's a funny one, because I guess I'm technically Scottish. I mean, I often feel like most of my connection with Scotland is annoying Scottish people by telling them I'm Scottish when I'm clearly not, and I sound like this and I talk like this. But I was born there. My family are from there. And always kind of had a sort of sense of connection to the place. But like, one thing I think pop culture often misses out on is like, there is the kind of strand of kind of Scottish culture, which is very like, you know, weather beaten, kind of Highland, your Bravehearts, your Highlanders, your kind of, you know, overblown dwarves with big beards shouting at stuff. But then there's also like a whole like strata of Scottish culture, which is much more weird and whimsical and kind of folksy. You know, it's the kind of Scotland of Gregory's Girl and, you know, the music of King Creosote and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's certainly represented in one of the games we're talking about today. And I think part of the reason I wanted to chat to you about this game, because about Still Wakes the Deep, which we'll come to, is like, I know you enjoyed it, but also to me, it felt like a version of Scotland hadn't really seen before, like the amount of effort that'd been kind of put into it and the amount of focus that they'd given it kind of from a cultural perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think the key thing for me is that I was doing some thoughts before the pod to try and think about like games that do, I know it's a rare thing to occur in my life. I was trying to think of games that like represent Scotland in a way that's like quite natural and not really just like this sort of weird forced thing. And I couldn't think of any actually. Like Dear Esther does a nice depiction of the Hebrides, I guess, but I don't think you play as a Scot in that game. I worked on an adaptation of 39 Steps 100,000 years ago, and that had a fairly realistic portrayal of Scotland. But yeah, Still Wakes is the only one I've played in quite a long time that really struck me as like, oh, this feels natural. It doesn't feel like these people are Scottish just for a bit or just to make Americans happy because they like the way that sounds.
Not to put you on the spot, Paul, but what about A Highland Song?
Oh, that's such a good game. yeah, okay. Also A Highland Song. That's a game I worked on, full disclosure. I was the art director on that game. But yeah, that's an interesting one because it is kind of fantastical. And actually, I feel like a lot of Scottish developers, when we approach games in our own country, we will often push that sort of slightly fantastical, rose-tinted look at the world, basically. I'm happy to talk about it if you would like to hear about it. But yes, that's a cool game for sure. And I worked on that with Inkle, and they're lovely.
I think one of my proudest moments ever is saying to you on a Twitch stream that the art in it reminded me of the Katie Morag books.
And yes.
You saying yes.
Yeah, that was an unusual reference, but it's true. That kind of, for anyone who hasn't seen it, the game has a sort of very painterly kind of splatted style where like there's lots of textures and it's split up in a kind of three-dimensional way, but everything's 2D. So the idea was to make it look like a painting, which is not an original thought for a video game. Loads of games tried to do that. But I actually think it was quite successful thanks to the amazing folks at Inkle who know how to make games good. I just showed them how to make them look pretty. So is that a sentence?
Absolutely. I think like a Highland Song is like a very like, it is, I'd hesitate to say a kind of touristy view of Scotland, but I mean, it has that kind of element to it that you're looking at these kind of like tourist maps, right? It's almost like a kind of, to a point, a kind of received version of Scotland, but it's done with like such a kind of intensity and beauty that it doesn't ever feel like pat or kind of, you know, parodic. It feels very, very like heartfelt. And having the kind of hills be alive with all these kind of myths and legends that you're kind of encountering there. Like, I don't know, it's like you can imagine that going too hard and it feeling like sappy or saccharine, but it doesn't at all. It's got a lovely, like, heartfelt sense to it, which I think is, again, shared in a couple of the games we're going to talk about today as well. And I think often that's the, for me, that's the kind of the acid test, right? Is if something feels like genuinely earnest in the story it's trying to tell, it's very hard to dislike it ultimately or to feel too cynical about it.
Your dad's from Scotland, right, Jamie?
Yeah, so like my father is like, I don't know how many of them are actually Scottish who are actually born in Scotland, but they've certainly adopted Scotland as their country over the last few decades. And my dad, yeah, he's written a bunch of, like, before he got embroiled in teen drama skins, he was, you know, kind of writing big, bold Scottish, you know, dramas on the BBC. So there was the adaptation of Ian Banks's A Crow Road, which I would say is a masterpiece. I know my dad wrote it, but it's like very, very good. It's a big, complex, kind of ambitious story about a fucked up Scottish family. My dad comes from a very fucked up, possibly Scottish family. So I think, it kind of has that to it. And like, that's like that Ian Banks world is really interesting because it's kind of, he often portrays the world of kind of weird, old money, rich Scotland, which again is a very particular kind of vibe. But kind of works for kind of grand, operatic stories of sort of sex and death and family secrets and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, which is like, again, like a whole tradition of storytelling in Scotland, that kind of stuff. It kind of imprinted on me as a child, I think, because there's a lot of it about.
Well, my dad is called Paul, and that's why I'm here.
Strong name.
That's my qualification. to have an opinion about this.
because obviously, as the rule goes, only a Scot can have an opinion about Scotland, right? That is the that's written on the stone of Scone.
It's true. It's true.
Even if it's on a technicality. Still Wakes the Deep came out this year. It was made by the Chinese Room and is the thing on an oil rig. Let's move on. I think it's that was how Dan Pinchbeck of the Chinese Room sort of pitched it. It very much is that. And he wrote and sort of started off the project, I think, before leaving the Chinese Room. I think there's a very kind of sweet leaving letter he wrote that's posted on their website, which I'll include in the show notes. Where he's just kind of saying, like, I got in this to kind of got into this to sort of make art and make small projects, and now I've got this colossal team with hundreds of people on it. I'm off, but I love you guys. But I think you can sort of still feel his fingerprints all over this game. So the story follows an electrician called Kaz, who's trapped on a oil drilling platform in the North Sea in the 1970s when disaster strikes and there's monsters and body horror and horrible things going on. And it's very much in the walking simulator, horror walking simulator sort of genre of games, as you kind of navigate this space following lots and lots and lots of yellow paint to turn wheels and replace fuses and dodge monsters on your journey to kind of escape this place. Paul, what did you think about this game?
I bloody loved it, to be honest. I played it immediately upon release on my stream. So I actually had to go back and rewatch some of that to try and remember what happened in it, because I don't actually have a memory. But for me, it worked really well. It didn't overstay its welcome, which I love. I think it was like 4.5 hours or something for my playthrough of that. And it just encapsulates a lot of my favorite stuff. You know, like that kind of the thing take on Lovecraft, a Scottish setting that really landed for me. The performances I thought were phenomenal. Pretty much all of the characters, I think, felt pretty grounded. And also, I mentioned this to Chris earlier, like I've talked a lot on my stream and so on about having a genuine phobia of oil rigs. I've always been terrified of them. So I was legitimately freaked out the entire time playing this game. Every time Kaz had to go like hopping around on the gantries, I was just like absolutely freaking out. So yeah, it really, really landed for me in a big way, I'd say.
Yeah, I finished it yesterday, actually, playing it for the pod. I haven't come to it kind of late. And I really, really enjoyed it as well. It's interesting. It's a really interesting balance of, like, obviously, Chinese Room made their name or kind of formed around Dear Esther. And I think it has way more of Dear Esther's DNA than I expected, both as a game of, like, loops around an environment and back again, obviously, with a much more horrifying context, but also as a kind of meta plot about, like, someone's life going slightly wrong. And Dear Esther is sort of otherworldly in a kind of artistic sense, and this literalizes that a little bit more with cool membranes that are oil on the surface of the water, etc., etc., etc. Really beautiful. I mean, probably should talk about how good it looks. And actually, I think it's an interesting balance of, because they subsequently did things like Amnesia, Machine for Pigs, and things that are kind of more in that, I was trying to think of a word for it earlier, that sort of like labyrinth horror game genre, which can be either cheap or clever, which is basically you're in a maze, there is a monster, don't get grabbed. And there's a little bit of that in Still Wakes the Deep, but it's relatively slight and linear otherwise, in a way that I quite enjoyed, because I meant I could kind of power through it with some momentum. And I think they've said that that was the case. They didn't want people to get stuck on a puzzle or a really hard stealth bit or something like that. It does deflate some of the tension of it, I think, but I think the sort of spectacle of it and the sort of, as you say, Paul, the quality of the performances carry it through that, even as I think, and this would be something I'd like to dig into, in its 4.5 hour runtime, I feel like it, well, actually, to back up a second, it's interesting because in a sense, it really is the thing on an oil rig. But what it doesn't do, and I think the reason, the place where the thing comparison collapses a little bit, is the thing is primarily a thriller, right? Like, yes, it has horror elements and monster elements, but primarily it's a psychological, social horror, right? Like, it's about trust and so on, more so than it is about the monster itself. Whereas Still Wakes the Deep is much more about the horror and the monster scenario, right? Like, it's not about distrust of other people necessarily, not beyond a certain point. And as such, it kind of hits a kind of escalatory point quite early and kind of stays there. And what this boiled down to for me is I was thinking, I think I too don't really want to go to an oil rig, I think. I find them sort of fascinating and... my mum was a customs official, so I have very strong memories of like going to visit her at work down like in sort of Liverpool docks, say there's huge boats and stuff. And so there's parts of me that will always resonate really strongly with like big industrial cranes and machinery and loading stuff in cargo containers and stuff like that. But I think if I went to an oil rig, I'd only fall off it maybe once. Partly because I would die the first time, but I think it is, to me, it is remarkable how many times Kaz, a very evocatively presented everyman, not an everyman in the generic sense, but truly like a relatively human protagonist, does and can fall off a whole oil rig.
Yeah, he does it several times throughout the course of the game.
Scots are famously hardy, Chris. I think you're forgetting how astonishingly hardy we are. As terrified as I am.
70 meters off the top of an oil rig and then just be sort of fished out moments later.
I mean, I'm just saying, I think there's a phrase which is like, fall off an oil rig once, shame on you. Fall off an oil rig twice, shame on me. Fall off an oil rig 3 times. Shame on the extra dimensional horror. We shouldn't have drilled out the North Sea. Like, that's that's my take on it.
The reason I don't want to go to an oil rig is because I'm scared of the men who work there shouting at me for getting things wrong, which is always the main barrier between me being a roughneck or working on a North Sea trawler.
I mean, that's why I barely leave the house, Jamie, to be honest.
But I will say, as a walking simulator, I think it's probably the most kind of sumptuous and kind of artistically ambitious one I've played. I think even though, yes, you are falling off that oil rig quite a lot of times, the manner in which you're doing it is pretty spectacular. You know, over the course of the game, the oil rig kind of, you get to walk across it at the start, which is like one of the best bits, right? You're just like walking across an oil rig.
The bits inside were nice. Yeah, the level of environmental detail was truly wonderful. Like, I spent a long time just, you know, reading everything in every room. And actually, it had some genuinely good world building where you started to get a sense of what each character was about before you get to kind of run into them, which I thought was quite clever.
Yeah, it feels like a functional place as well. Like, I assume it's, you know, relatively realistic in some dimensions. And it certainly feels like the way that it's kind of laid out and the kind of route that you take through it feels very logically satisfying. So, yeah, I think even though, yes, you are doing kind of like broad loops of the rig, broken up only by falling into the sea and being fished out again several times, I think getting to see that thing kind of disintegrate and fall apart was just, yeah, very, very satisfying, I think. It's just cool seeing shit disintegrate over a period of time. And I think an oil rig is just such a spectacular location for that, right? Because it's sort of compact but dense and isolated.
I think what it isn't is, and because the games that it draws comparison to is something like an Alien Isolation, right? Space station, oil rig, kind of broadly similar setups, right? Like, you're in a closed environment with something, the creature. And Alien Isolation, for example, sort of builds a game around like getting you to learn that space and sort of strategize your interaction with it. And, you know, that's the sort of where the game is, whereas Still Wakes the Deep is much more linear. And so it doesn't, I don't say this is necessarily a criticism, but it doesn't use the oil rig as a, like a close environment. It's expecting you to learn. In fact, it just sort of like, it breaks the oil rig in ways that open up new routes for you or that kind of demand that you take a new route, which is often a kind of like a new cinematic perspective on this disaster that's unfolding. Like, I'll avoid spoilers, but like towards the end, you kind of have to make like a precarious crossing across the top of the oil rig or across a fallen crane, which becomes your like highest vantage point yet. And that feels like very much like an artistic moment of crescendo, right? Like, as it puts you right at the top of the rig as night falls and things get much more intense. And so it's kind of interesting that like that environment would also lend itself really well to a kind of a slightly more open-ended or strategic horror game, whereas this is very much like, as I would expect from the Chinese Room, like a roller coaster that sort of has these very planned moments of like escalation and relief and being chased is a big relief, I find.
I find it interesting, actually. Sorry to cut in. The lack of video really is terrible for knowing when to speak. I'm kind of surprised they didn't incorporate a little more open world stuff in it, actually, because they did that the year before with, or maybe that was Frictional Games. I think I'm getting confused with the two companies that make the same games. Frictional did Amnesia the Bunker the year before, which was somewhat open world, if I recall. I think that it was a little bit more Alien Isolation.
Kind of it's the first sort of Amnesia game to really go back into mechanics. And in this game you're literally a mechanic, but not a mechanics. So but you know, that last Amnesia game, yeah, it's a kind of little it's great. It's like a little immersive sim space, right? Where you've got like the game sort of tells you at the beginning of that one, like you can, if you can think of it, you can try it. And actually, no, you can't. There's not like a Deus Ex style possibility space there. There's a few things that you can do to kind of fend off the monster in that one. But it's still enough to kind of feel like a really responsive little world. This game doesn't feel particularly responsive. It feels like convincingly, you know, derelict and dangerous, but it definitely doesn't feel like anything that you're kind of having a kind of, any kind of choice of what happens next, you know.
I think there is like a, that has a, like a, ten, like it, that is tension relieving in the sense that you don't get the choice anxiety of getting it wrong or missing things. Like, I think they could have easily kind of messed the game up a bit by sort of punishing you for not exploring really broadly, for example. Like, I felt quite comfortable just sort of doing what the character would do. You know what I mean? Like, you fall into a horrible sort of tank of oily water in the dark and you put your torch on. What you don't do is swim around the bottom looking for collectibles. What you do is try and get the fuck out, you know, like that. And that it's very effective at, I think. And it's an interesting question about horror and games. I think it's very effective at, well, I think this choice to make a much lower agency, more linear game is absolutely intentional and effective because it does keep you focused on the things it wants you to focus on, the story and the atmosphere and so on. What I will say is I think because of that, sometimes it plays its hand mechanically a little too obviously. You could actually turn off the yellow paint in the menu, but it is quite hard to navigate without it because the environments are so detailed. But there is like, there was a moment, you know, no spoilers, but you will get hunted by some pretty cool monsters, actually, I will say. It has some pretty good, just fucking real, like someone put some time into tendril technology.
Yes, real grotty weirdos, those guys. Oh my god!
Also, just some excellent shouting as well. Like these are very much Lovecraftian entities that like to shout at you, which well, again that's... plays into my fear of being shouted at by men on oil rigs. So I guess that's why the game was so effective.
Yeah. There is a sequence. I think one thing it does do is like there's a thing that I think all horror games do, which is probably just part of the fun of the genre, which is like I really don't want to go there. And the game is full of people telling you like, Kaz, you've got to go down into the generators again. And no, the lights are all off and all of the stairs are going to give you tetanus. Bye. And you don't really want to go down to the generators again, but you're going to. And there is a sequence where sort of a series of chain monster evasion moments in a set of environments that you get to explore relatively freely before the threat arrives. That was an example for me where it fell down a little bit because it really plays its hand, because the only places that little hidey hole vents and lockers to hide in show up are where the monster will later be.
Mm.
Right. So the moment, like, you'll see a prompt pop up that says, you know, press, I was playing on the PlayStation, press square to hide in a locker. And I'll be like, well, I don't think I need to right now, but I guess I will later. Game, thank you for putting this here. And so I think sometimes it can play its hand a little bit, obviously, but also I could imagine someone making their way through this who absolutely wouldn't finish Amnesia the Bunker or Soma or Alien Isolation or another one of these games. And so, yeah, like,
I think I've got like a lot of patience for these games. I think I really, really enjoy playing through a movie, basically. Like, I was kind of struck by the kind of, you know, we talk about these things as walking simulators, and that's kind of, you know, a joke that stuck, right? And I think I've heard, it might have even been Dan Pinchbeck, like, call them, like, don't want to call them walking simulators, let's call them empathy simulators. Like, no, thank you. You know, the fact that you're sort of playing through this cinematic story from a first-person perspective, where, yes, you are just walking forward or running forward or, you know, climbing and doing some basic stuff. I'm like very happy there. I don't need complication or puzzles or that much friction, really. Like, I felt like this game really found the sweet spot of like, oh, okay, I've died a couple of times trying to do this stealth section. I'll do it the third time, you know. And I don't know, for some reason, it feels like I could take an infinite number of these as a genre, because I'm just always really happy to kind of, you know, it's something games have kind of always done. Like a first person perspective is just a very, very kind of, you know, it's been part of gaming for a long time now. And like the fact that these kind of games are still quite rare and quite few and far between, I think is a little bit unusual, actually, because actually I find being in a story, inhabiting a character who's talking with his own voice, I find just like, I found it more in this game than I have for quite a long time. Like, I find it just very fun and evocative and an exercise in kind of immersion that is just really rare and good.
Yeah, actually, to pick up on something you said there, one of the things I really loved about it was that there were no like tricky puzzles hidden in there that you had to sort of slow down the pace and spend a long time on. I think there are a few sort of very brief ones where you sort of look at a diagram and basically do what it says, but that felt very in keeping with Kaz's character, I suppose, that he'd just be able to kind of figure it out. And I really enjoyed, again, yeah, like you're saying, the level of difficulty in the game is extremely low, but I do think it had some pretty good tension throughout and actually some really good scares here and there. I'm curious if either of you actually found it scary. I felt like it had a few sort of genuinely unsettling moments. Like there was a sort of, no spoilers, but there's a bit where a diving bell is like shaking around and screaming, and it kind of reminded me of PT, the PT fridge. but I find it quite unsettling, actually. I would say the first half I found it quite unsettling, and I thought it was quite effective.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah.
Who will speak?
That's intake of breath war.
Yeah, indeed. That was a polite form of English duel, where we both stand in a kind of invisible door waiting for the other one to walk through it. I agree. I don't think it's an especially scary game, even by the virtue standards of its jump scares. Like, there's a couple, but they weren't, it's certainly not anywhere near like PT territory or anything like that. There's a bunch of unsettling moments. I found a lot of the anxiety actually came from early on, sort of the uncertainty of what it was I was going to be asked to do. And strangely, as I realized, oh, this game is actually going to be very linear and kind of hold my hand through things, I kind of relaxed enough to just sort of enjoy the ride. And, you know, the only times I even kind of died were due to like maybe getting a bit lost in a underwater section where you're at risk of drowning or something like that. And, you know, maybe once or twice getting caught by a monster. I didn't find it. I found it, I mean, some of the atmospheric stuff is really beautiful. I think it drew inspiration from things like Annihilation as well, in terms of its depiction of a kind of sort of certainly Lovecraftian, but very much sort of cosmic horror threat that is never really explained. And I think that's the right choice. And I think like it hangs that stuff well. I have to admit, and I don't want to, if you want to answer the question about horror, Jamie, go for it. But to respond to something else you said as well, I do agree that these sort of first person sort of cinematic narrative games can be a really good vehicle for experience, right? Particularly for atmospheric experience. And I think it's a very natural venue for cosmic horror, particularly. I think it's really good for it. I find that it is of mixed success for me as a vector for empathy for the character that I'm playing. And the reason for that is because for me, the agency of whoever I am and their story and what they want are always going to be slightly at odds with one another because I'm controlling that character, right? I can see these other like amazing characters in the environment. There's lots of them in this game, and sort of feel for them or kind of invest in their story. But I find it quite hard to resonate with something like, so no spoilers, but Kaz has a backstory. There's a reason he's on the oil rig. And that's really crucial to several sort of flashback sequences through the game, which discusses relationship with his wife and so on. And that stuff, like, it's beautifully performed and beautifully presented. Like, the production values are absolutely incredible. But that for me isn't my, I would connect much more to that sort of thing in a film where I'm just seeing both performers interact with one another. And I don't feel like one of them is kind of me, because where I found that walking simulators do this really well is something like, well, actually I'm trying to think of an example, but forgive me. I've completely blanked on Edith Finch. There we go. Almost blanked on the name. Where you play, as you do in Dear Esther and Gone Home, someone sort of investigating the aftermath of someone else's life. Like, you're literally picking through a location that is Dear Esther is a slight exception to that, but in What Remains of Edith Finch and The Police Are Here Because of This Take, it's too hot. The fact that you are sort of simply kind of allowed to be the player as a spectator to this life that can be really, I thought it was really touching in What Remains of Edith Finch, where your own identity is a kind of slow burn reveal. Even though I will call out, and I'm glad you made notes here, Jamie, for the credit, like Alex Newman's performance as Kaz is really incredibly good. Like, and all of the performances in the game are incredibly good. The medium does not lend itself for me to like his story particularly.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mention What Remains of Edith Finch, because I still think that is probably, I mean, that game might be the reason I work in games now. It's like, you know, that kind of game blew my mind. And I think one of the things it does in its storytelling is create layers between the subject of the story and the player. There's like layers upon layers in that game. You know, there's the metaphorical ways in which the stories are portrayed to you. There is the kind of identity of the protagonist. There's the way that the house that you're exploring kind of becomes impossible as you go. And it like, it stacks these kind of frictions on top of each other, which makes it this extraordinary exercise in empathy and symbolism, right? That's how it gets around this problem of just simply, you know, narrating who this guy is in this time and place. And I think I do agree that Still Wakes the Deep has quite a, it goes for a very, very simple story in terms of Kaz's journey through the game. Like, there's no spoilers to say that the setup is he's come to the oil rig to kind of escape from the police, who he's in trouble with for having a fight in a pub. and that's the kind of the beginning and end of his kind of you know, who he is as a character. It's not who he is as a character, but like that is all it is. Like, it's very low level. It's like literally domestic. And that's clearly a choice that they've made to keep his story small. And his journey through the game is, you know, not exactly revelatory. He's a nice guy who fucked up, who tried to run away from his problems, and is now faced this kind of life and death battle. I think it's interesting to talk about The Thing, because one of the fucking brilliant things about The Thing, right, is that the men in it are just, they are presented basically without backstory and basically like without reference to what their lives were before here, before this place. And that creates this incredible sense of kind of dynamic between them, right? Because it's just in the here and now, whereas this game doesn't have that kind of, you know, that would be a very different game, but, you know, perhaps a bolder choice to kind of, you know, really situate these people in the here and now and let the player kind of, you know, play his own story.
The other story that works exactly like that as well is Alien, where everyone is like, the relationships between the crew is kind of unspoken, right? Like, what's going on between Ripley and Dallas? It's never really said, right? And the closest you get to a backstory is the fact that Ash is new, really, you know? And I think that's quite effective. Like, I'm not saying it would be more effective in this case. Like, to be clear, I do think it is a good set of characters. But I'm not sure to me, like, how much extra because I did find it, you know, it dramatically effective in particular moments as well. But I'm not sure how much of that was attached to Kaz specifically, which is the thing I would call out. Because there are other characters whose fates and final moments, etc., I found were for me the dramatic highlight of it.
Is it? Do you think it's Kaz's story itself that you don't resonate with, like in terms of the sort of, I guess, the dissonance between playing it and hearing it, or is it something else? I'm kind of curious.
I could get real, real wanky about this.
Oh, let's go! I've got a glass of wine right here. Let's.
Yeah. So I think so. There's the other things I would kind of compare it to are things like Color Out of Space, particularly the story, not the Nicolas Cage film, but the Nicolas Cage film is a lot of fun. It has kind of Color Out of Space energy for me in terms of the nature of the threat as well, particularly as a particular Lovecraft thing, it would be that. And I think for me, the real appeal of this kind of horror is like that confrontation with sort of like raw, unfathomable madness in some way, right? That sort of idea that like just beyond the doors of your perception is this screaming abyss of kind of sensory overload. And there's like a kind of emotional ramp up to that point. And like, and those stories kind of push people to that breaking point and then past it. And it's quite a hard thing to achieve in a game because, pointedly, it's always never described directly in those kinds of stories, right? Like Lovecraft stories are traditionally often a story within a story, right? Like Call of Cthulhu famously is like four stories within a story. The narrator is just the person assembling all of these different sources. And that technique is used to kind of allow your imagination to fill in the rest of what this realm of domain of madness or kind of the unknown actually is. It is always, you know, it's literally per like the mountains of madness. It's always the next mountain range that gets you. It's not the one you're on. It's the one beyond this one. And so it's always going to be a struggle, I think, to literalize it. I think as a like an artistic expression of that, there's some really spectacular stuff in Still Wakes the Deep. But for me, it makes for a pairing I don't always vibe with when it's paired with a small domestic human story. Now, I think Still Wakes the Deep actually does use it quite well. I can't really talk about how without getting into spoiler territory, so I won't. But like in the sense that like where this person's mind goes when they're under such extreme duress, I think that does work. And as I say, I think that central performance is strong enough to make you really get as close as you possibly can to feeling it. But I think it puts the game on this slightly split path where you as a player are on your own journey of understanding with these things and this experience, and Kaz is on his. and you're both in the same body, and you're sort of, you'll never quite align. And I guess I'll say one thing, and this isn't a spoiler, but being in proximity to the evil, this alien energy, it's happening again, kind of forces Kaz to hear aspects of his history, right? Aspects of his voices from his past and things like that. And that to me is a little too close to sort of dramatic sleight of hand for comfort. It's sort of on the edge of artifice, and therefore it's like slightly puts me at a remove from him in his experience, because obviously that isn't mine. It puts me in the position of audience, which is analogous to, I think, the way the game puts you in the position of audience by kind of putting you on rails. But yeah, anyway, I told you this would get wanky, but I think that whole territory has like a kind of anxious relationship with cosmic horror for me. But I appreciate that. But it is nonetheless effective at what it does, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, that there's something to that. I think the thing that you're describing, like, again, I won't spoil anything, but like, there's a frightening idea in there somewhere about why it is your character experiences that when he's close to the alien stuff, right? And I think, yeah, if there's one thing the game is lacking, I think it is a little bit more of the void in that, like a little bit more of something like genuinely beyond our our kind of understanding. You know, I think Bloodborne still remains probably the best extension of kind of Lovecraftian ideas of kind of being at the mercy of something that you just can't comprehend at all. Whereas actually the aliens or the entities in this are relatively comprehensible, right? And I think it would have been nice to have a bit more of that that kind of magic in there, I suppose.
Yeah.
Dark Lovecraftian magic.
I mean, I'm watching the third season of Twin Peaks right now, and truly, if there's anything for game developers to draw from in creating a sense of horror and confusion, it's that series. Because I don't know if you've seen it, but there's some truly astonishingly weird stuff in there that is the kind of thing you never see in a depiction of like Lovecraftian horror, because we've seen it all before, really. Whereas this show, my mouth is agape basically the entire time.
My mouth is
my mice are agape.
well, that's deeply Lovecraftian in and of itself, to be honest.
Truly.
I mean, yes, I think Twin Peaks Series 3 is an unqualified masterpiece that kind of, I know, I basically am always thinking about a given time of day. And certainly there is that sense of kind of shimmering violence behind the veil is kind of ever present in that one. Mm. I never thought I would find Matthew Lillard's crying face so deeply unsettling and upsetting. That's Shaggy, man.
It's wonderful.
it's very good. Just to call out another performance in there, Finley, who's the one woman on board, very much like not the kind of woman that video games tend to do, right? And she's just a great character. She's voiced by Karen Dunbar, who's a comedian from Glasgow, and she just like, I just love her character. She kind of, some of the guys kind of slightly blend into each other, but she stands out because, like I say, she's the only woman, and she's also just got kind of a really kind of great vibe of being one of those people who's kind of, you know, spent her entire life amongst the lads and is kind of one of them, but is also the kind of the moral core of the story. Like, she's the one who kind of goes on a journey as well, rather than just being like horribly consumed.
Yeah, she is wonderful.
Sorry. I think also crucially, she has an arc with like some pretty like big turns in it, which I will say, like, I think it has on your tour of the oil rig, there are some real bastards, you know what I mean? And again, there's a little bit of unsubtlety to the fact that it's the bastards who will be chasing you later. You know what I mean? Like, to go back to the fear of being shouted at on an oil rig, they do certainly, these fell energies do settle upon the yelly, the men who were yelling anyway.
Yes, so
maybe
absolutely.
Maybe that's how that works. this force from the unknown just sort of feeds on however much of an asshole you are.
Warps shout out Clive with... Russell as Rennick for being truly awful.
She's Finley's the sort of Wilford Brimley of this game, right? She kind of fills in that part. I love how in the thing when like Wilford Brimley, just as a sidebar on the thing, like when he's doing that autopsy on the alien and he's like taking all of its mad organs out and stuff like that. I love how upset he is by it all. Like, he's just like, doing some great like Wilford Brimley noises all the way.
I thought dog. Yeah, every line in that movie is absolute gold.
Yes. So yeah, Still Wakes Are Deep. I think very good. Very good game. I think it bodes well for Bloodlines 2. I mean, I never played. I know it's a kind of buggy classic, Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, if that's the title. And I know that game has had a very up and down development, but I do think with this game, it kind of sets an interesting, you know, you can see that this team are very, very skilled at, you know, a number of things that you would probably value in a game like that, right? And I kind of made me kind of much more interested for that game, actually, having, you know, never played the game or really understood that world at all.
Yeah, I find it kind of interesting because for me, I love Bloodlines, and Bloodlines is very much about agency and sort of carving your own path through the vampire night.
Delicious.
So it'll be. I'm really. Yeah, I'm interested to see what the Chinese Dream's take on that is, because it is against type. I think they could do something very effective with that setting, and I hope they do. And truthfully, I don't think Bloodlines is a game that. I'm not saying that anything doesn't need a sequel, but it's very self-contained as an experience, right? And it you know, it doesn't need to be followed up as exactly as it is. But I am interested to see what they do with it. Is it going to have a Lacuna Coil song over the credits? That would seem against type for the Chinese Room, but you know, we'll see.
Just want to go play Bloodlines now, to be honest, but yeah. Great game, wonderful game.
You're one of those games now where if you want to play it, you have to read several wildly contradictory articles about which patch you should run to play it properly. All right, well, we've talked about Still Wakes Are Deep. Before we talk about Judero, I would like to just briefly alight on Xenotilt, which, Chris, you mentioned on a podcast I was editing a couple of weeks ago, and I just thought, oh, I'll download this. This sounds fun. He's giving this a good airing. And it has fucking swallowed my life. Every spare moment, I have just played and played and played that game. I've played 20 plus hours since you mentioned it.
Wow.
Which is, you know, I've got two kids. Like 20 hours is like more or less impossible. I don't know how I got there.
One of them's gone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. She belongs to the pinball now. But it's such a fucking good game. I think it might be my favorite game of the year. I love it. I absolutely love it. My highest score is like 250 million.
Wow.
I know. My second highest score is like 100 million, right? Mm. So... And that first score I got like 10 hours in. So I have been like chasing that high ever since, and it has been absolutely glorious. Just incredible. So good. I love it so much. It's like the learning curve of it has just been so satisfying, like because it's pinball and because you're sort of seconds from death at any given moment, there's something just completely visceral about it. And like puzzling out, it's like quite arcane mechanics and sort of systems, which will more or less proc just by play, right? But if you kind of go for the sort of missions it gives you and start locking in balls into your matrix and all that sort of stuff, it really starts popping off. And it's a bit like what happened with Bellatro for everyone earlier in the year. Like, I've just become completely addicted to all its kind of bleeps and bings, and like, when you finally get the multi-ball, which is like a big deal, it's hard to get.
That thing's insane.
The game like stops for a second, it slows down, and then kind of explodes. in a kind of, you know, pretty like nakedly orgasmic fashion where everything just goes completely mental and your score multiplier starts going up and up and up. And yeah, it's just a bloody brilliant game and I'm completely obsessed with it. So I'd just like to say fuck you for that because it's eaten my life.
You've played significantly more of it than me now. And I'm still at the stage where I think my best is still like 22 million or something. Because I feel like I haven't broken through like the ball event horizon. And I say that because it is a pinball table that looks like the ship from Event Horizon. So I am still like, cause I play it in like 20-minute bursts when I need to like Ludovico technique my brain out of whatever it is that it's currently going through. So I'm yet to kind of see through the matrix and really understand anything that's going on, but I'm thrilled that it's worked for you.
The quest is to get, because it has a leaderboard which is only the people who've got a billion points, and that is going to be my task at the exclusion of all other activities, I think, for the next few months.
Incredible.
just to hit that billion, and then I can die happy having pleased the horny pinball table.
I really do need to play this. Wow.
You do. Okay. You do. I mean, yeah, seriously, you do. Like,
okay, it's on my list now. I'll grab it tomorrow.
It's really, really good. And it's like, I don't know. It's one of those, it's what's nice about it is it's still pretty obscure. Like, there's one little guide on Steam and there's a guy on YouTube just like who hasn't made any other videos kind of playing through like the kind of early game stuff in it to give you a kind of idea of it. And that's it. And that's actually really good because it means there's still so much of it that I don't understand. So it's great. Recommended. You probably got, they made a game called Demon's Tilt right before, which you may have a copy of free because it was often given away, so it's worth giving that one a go as well. I'd put like 4 hours into that. I'm all pinball now. shall we talk Judo?
Yes.
I haven't played it, so I'm going to sit here and think about pinball. Have fun.
Okay, this is an interesting one. I mean, do you want to introduce what it is, I guess?
You can give it a go if you want.
Oh, gosh. I mean, full disclosure, I played the demo.
Right.
And it didn't resonate with me, so I didn't get super deep into it. But it is a Scottish game, which is very cool. It has a very unique art style. Sort of scanned sculptures, I guess you would say, some of which are just action figures, and it plays out as a sort of isometric, I don't know how you describe it, action RPG without the RPG bits. You smack stuff with your stick, you can inhabit bodies, kind of like Messiah, the game probably no one remembers, but where you played as a weird baby who inhabited things, and it has a beautiful soundtrack. And it's got lots of lovely Scottish stuff. And it's absolutely minging to look at. And I bounced off it for that reason. But yeah. I was looking through my notes that I wrote while playing it. And I think I wrote, what did I say? I said, ugly as sin, but strangely compelling. And I think that kind of summed up the experience for me. The sort of 2 hours or so I played of it. I was quite captivated by the storytelling and I thought it was interesting, but I really bounced off it sort of visually and gameplay wise. So I'd be intrigued to see what you thought of it, Jimmy.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think it is a completely unique game. I've never played anything like it, really. And it's mostly the work of one guy called Jack King Spooner, he's called. And it was kind of kickstarted partly through production. It's all the things in it are made. So basically almost everything that you interact with or do in the game are kind of hand-modeled things that he's kind of scanned and put into the game. It does kind of look like ass, especially in the... especially in the kind of early game of it, right? But it also feels incredibly... like unique. It feels like the product of someone's imagination with all of the blinkers taken off, right? And someone who is clearly very, very like kind of creatively inspired and kind of mad and kind of eccentric and has put all of those aspects of them into a game without really worrying too much, I think, about what anyone thinks or feels about it. Mm. And there's a video, I'll put it in the show notes, there's a video he put on his Kickstarter explaining how he made the game. And he's this softly spoken, eccentric Scottish guy who, like, he's like, part of the video is him saying, like, I work in this, like, little hut, and the other guy who shares this space is never here, but he's got loads of corn husks in sacks on his desk. And, like, this is just a detail that he gives in the making of video. It's the kind of guy he is. And, like,
I did watch it. It's very, very charming.
Yeah, it's deeply charming. Very hard to dislike that, basically, and where he's coming from there. One thing that I found with the game, right, is that you wander around, you hit things with your stick, you have conversations with kind of village folk, you walk into people's houses. It's kind of got almost like a Zelda vibe to it in a funny kind of way. And it's very, very aimless. You're given sort of a task to do, but it's very, very obscure. And the game kind of takes place in a kind of... I mean, it's funny because it shares something with A Highland Song in that it's kind of a land of folklore and kind of dreams and spirits and weird, you know, lots of people having, sex with, spectral beings that they find in the countryside and being visited by, you know, unholy, unborn, whatever's afterwards. It's that kind of folk, right?
That's the Highland Song DVD, DLC, by the way. DLC, spoilers.
Yeah. The Bloody Baron DLC. So it's got that kind of vibe to it, as well as like loads of like really beautiful traditional folk music over the top. And also, like, when you meet any new monster, it will cut to a kind of like amateurish stop frame animation, like introduction for it. Some of them are quite funny. Like, one, there's like a horrible, like, temptress witch thing who kind of screams and shouts at you, and then it cuts to you having tea with her. The game is like deeply original, deeply personal. Very, very aimless. But one thing that is kind of fascinating about it is it actually is backloaded in terms of quality. So, like, a lot of games will often like put their best foot forward, right? That tends to be the pattern of things, or at least give you a taste of the kind of magic to come. This game starts off kind of whimsical and becomes progressively weirder, and actually, I found as I was playing through it that it really lacked a spine. It really lacked kind of one thing it was giving me that kind of gave me a reason to be there. It was just a very dispersed experience and a very fragmented experience. And although there was lots of artistry on show and lots of craftsmanship and lots of like funny things and funny gags and like really obscure Scottish references, there wasn't one thing to kind of pull me along. I wanted to be thrown a rope by this game, right? And one game it ended up reminding me of was David O'Reilly's Everything, if you've played that game, which is the game where you're kind of in sort of abstract space and kind of communicating with a bunch of inanimate objects that will sort of say things to you and kind of. And that game is another game that I think is basically the product of an eccentric mind laid out before you, right? But I was thinking that game has these like audio clips of Alan Watts, the kind of philosopher, talking in a very clipped and attractive British accent that kind of punctuate the game. And I remember playing through the game and that was enough for me. Like finding this kind of British guy to kind of talk to me about the nature of reality kind of gave me that rhythm. Whereas Judero, I was just crying out for something like that, for something to give it some sort of rhythm. But it's just too improvisatory. But as it goes on, and as the game kind of progresses to its finale, it gets progressively weirder and weirder and weirder, and also more ambitious and more psychedelic. And the kind of ending of it is really quite extraordinary. And I think it's interesting because I think often, yeah, as creators, we tend to front load things. But with Judero, actually, the game has a real sense of being personally crafted and kind of personally complete. It doesn't feel compromised. And so the fact that it opens up as it goes on and becomes more and more magical and more kind of abstract and sort of more meaningful as it does, I think is kind of testament to the fact that this guy is just completely uncompromised in his vision. But it was quite an effort to get there. it was very unusual, but I think it needs to get out of its own way a little bit. But again, it's just very hard to dislike anything that's this personal and is this literally handcrafted, right?
Yeah, I think that's, like, if I can add a point to that that kind of came up there, me being sort of critical of its art is not because it's bad in a sort of weird way. It's really interesting because what you perfectly kind of summed it up there. It's very much a person's vision, and it doesn't feel like an accident that it looks this way. It's a very intentional looking game. You know, all the assets are made a certain way. The palette, the lighting is done a certain way, clearly to fit his specific vision for the game. And I actually really admire that. I think from a point of view of art direction, that's actually a really exciting kind of way to go with it. It's just the danger is, obviously, art is very subjective. Some people are going to bounce off it horribly. And I found it difficult to engage with just because it didn't align with my tastes. But I do think it deserves to be sort of lauded as truly original, as you said. Like, it really is. There is nothing else that looks like this, which is kind of exciting, to be honest.
Yeah, he talks in that video about, you know, making things perfect and making things beautiful being a kind of barrier to getting things done and getting things made. And he likes the idea that he can literally mold something in his hand and then put it in the game and for it to be kind of ready. And again, like, it's just, I'm so glad that that voice is in video games, right? That kind of instinct is there, because there's just something very, very valuable to that. That, like, this guy is, like, properly weird and properly creative and, you know, kind of laying it all out there in this earnest kind of way. But yeah, I just, despite finding it, you know, pretty frustrating in some facets, I'm just very glad it exists and happy to, you know, ping the dev, you know, 15 or so quid for it.
So I watched the trailers and things, despite not having played it. I did actually mean to, getting around to it, so I was finishing Still Works Today. One of my takes on it is, like, and I kind of agree with that, I think for me, it's nice when something comes along and demonstrates that there are ways to make games beyond the kind of, what sometimes can feel like the narrowing set of tools that everybody uses. And it's funny that something like animation or 3D modeling is a traditional barrier to entry for people. And so having the kind of novel step of, like, well, maybe I can't use Maya, but I can make this out of clay with my actual hands is, like, an interesting way to expand the frame of, like, what, how one makes a video game, right? And as a way into making games, I think it's kind of worth applauding, right? Like, there isn't a right and wrong way to do it. It's, and there are probably more ways than people consider normally.
Yeah, I'd actually love to show that to sort of aspiring game students, you know, like, I think that'd be kind of fascinating to break that barrier down somewhat. Like you say, you know, when you come to, because I've done, you know, talks to sort of kids at schools and stuff here and there, and it's always like, well, one day you'll become a 3D artist and sell your soul to the engine. But, like, with something like that, yeah, it's so fascinating to see a true artistic vision that is absolutely unique. And like you say, I don't want to make the comparison that this is a childish art style, but certainly it's something that might be more accessible visually to, like, younger developers who might want to just try this out, like, or just expand their horizons with what they can do with art, you know, in a game.
Yeah, it kind of demonstrates you can literally make games with the stuff you have lying around. And obviously,
yeah,
whether you have the tech to bring that into a game and actually digitize it is one thing, but, you know, to make a broader point for people who aspire to become game developers, paper prototypes are a real thing, right? You know, you can, you know, kind of make games with almost anything. I was about to tell a story then, but I shouldn't tell it.
Let me break an NDA for you.
Yeah. I've been many years ago now, more than a decade ago, I think, I was thrown out of a club in London. I was there with a well-known, very well-liked indie developer who got in trouble for making a game out of all the different pot plants in the club and rearranging them to form some sort of puzzle. And that got us kicked out into the streets of Earls Court, West London, at 2 a.m. And then wow. I accidentally broke into the wrong flat while trying to go home.
Oh, this is why we're friends, Chris. This, this is it.
That was one of the worst and weirdest. I must have told this story on the podcast before. Maybe
listeners will
let me know.
I don't think you have.
Yeah, I only had £10 in the entire world. So I tried to get a cab back to my friend that I was staying with. And then at a certain point, I had to like just tell the taxi driver, like, stop, I live here. I was wasted. And give him, because I saw the meter tick up to a tenner and that was all I had. And I was miles away, away. And then I walked from like maybe 3 a.m. till 7 a.m. trying to find my way back to my friend's flat. Eventually got there and stood outside and rang the bell and rang the bell and rang the bell and rang the bell. And eventually someone buzzed me in. I went upstairs and I walked inside and I was like, this feels wrong. And I looked at the post and it wasn't my friend's name and no one was around. And then I realized that I had been buzzing the wrong door, but my friend lived in like a row of flats that were all like identical on the inside, like in terms of their layout and so on. And I'd just come up the wrong staircase and it was like one too few down the line. And so I just silently exited this complete stranger's house, went outside and buzzed into the correct flat. And my friend let me in immediately and asked where I'd been. Anyway, this is why, kids, anyone can make games. Because I make games now and I'm a dipshit. There you go. That's the end of my story.
What an absolute straftat.
Here's my game.
Oh, is that Jamie, a segue?
Jamie, you're going to say something before we talk about the game of the year?
No, please tell me about the game of the year.
Straftat!
I have been unable to spell this, so it's one of those games where I've just heard the name written by you on our Discord, and I have absolutely no idea what it is.
All right.
Chris, what's Straftat?
Straftat is a 1v1 shooter game. It's free. It looks like a bad uncle and it smells like cigarettes. It's
correct. No further questions. Let's move on.
I discovered this game because of Graham, who discovered it's exactly the sort of thing Graham would find. So shout out to Graham for this discovery. I downloaded it on a whim. Played it exactly once, instantly realized that I probably won't enjoy a game this much this year. And then the next time Paul and I were going to play a game together, I basically screamed Straftat at you.
Repeatedly.
Made you download it without telling you what it was. And then we started playing it. And, well, you immediately agreed it's the best game.
Ever made, I'd say. Yeah.
So Straftat is... So it is basically someone... And I don't really know anything about the developers yet. I think it's a pair of brothers... decided to make the deathmatch game that you want. It is a sort of a quick fire 1v1 deathmatch game with hundreds of levels. So the game is free, completely free, incredibly, with a £5 DLC. And if you buy the DLC and you host the lobby, your friend gets all the content for free, but it's worth buying just to support the developer. With the DLC, there's something like 150 maps and dozens and dozens and dozens of guns. And you and a friend join a lobby and you can sort of quick match with random people. And you play a random set of these maps with random guns until one of you hits 6 wins. And a win is just best of 3 on those maps. First to 2 kills wins the round. And you can maybe get 3 or 4 rounds in an hour. And we played it this morning, Paul, and we're basically just screaming the entire time. Yeah. It's got like all of the movement tech. It's got leaning and sliding and mantling and jumping. You play as these awful looking folded in little goblin-y men.
It's little freaks.
With little freaky hats guys. And and the UI is this sort of like, well, how did you describe it? Like a haunted Winamp skin.
Yeah, it feels like a Winamp skin, really. It's got that disgusting kind of early 2000s look to everything. It's absolutely glorious.
And the maps are, some of them, a lot of them are original, a lot of them are like simple geometry. Some of them are kind of directly inspired by COD maps, Halo maps, Half-Life maps, Quake maps. Just free with its inspiration. Same with the
weapons. Is there a Facing Worlds map?
That? I'm still hoping for that because there is a very Unreal Tournament sniper rifle, and like there has to be a Facing Worlds in there somewhere. We just haven't found it because there's so many bloody maps.
And then they get the kind of the like, and then occasionally the maps will throw like a complete curveball, like because basically it's the two of you spawning in an arena, and. Sometimes you'll spawn next to each other and you'll just have to sprint for the guns, which is very fun. There's one map which is like a huge ice pyramid in a sea of lava, and so you're both having to bunny hop constantly to stay on the ice while trying to kill each other. We played one earlier which is like an ice slide with a teleporter at the end that gets back to the top, and all the guns are sliding down the ice slide, and so you're falling down the ice slide trying to find the guns to kill each other desperately while also like accelerating.
I'm smiling from ear to ear just thinking about it, because it really is just astonishingly demented and the kind of thing everyone should play. It's interesting because like Chris and I played Slipgate a few years ago, which was felt very much like a kind of modern take on Unreal Tournament. Like it was really with portals. I don't know what that means, but it was very like relatively fast paced and it had the exact kind of movement of Unreal Tournament. But Straftat, oh boy! Like since we've been playing that, it's taken me back to playing on like the house computer in the late 90s. Like it has that like it feels like I'm playing Alien versus Predator or Blood 2 or something weird. It has this kind of weird feel to it where I feel like I've played this before, but also this is like a kind of haunted version that I'm now encountering.
It's glorious. It feels like being trapped within like the best Quake game jam you've ever played, and there's more content than, because you can't get bored of it really. Like even though we'll loop back to the same maps, like the weapons change, and the weapons are like absolutely mental. Like the names are mental. Some of them don't fucking work. And you can dual wield pretty much everything. There's a submachine gun called the Crisis, which whenever you pull the trigger, spaffs its entire clip in like an insane burst. And so two people trying to kill each other with that is very funny. But if you get two of them, you can just about kind of like spaff doubly down a corridor. There's melee weapons of surprising nuance in some ways.
There's a sort of helicopter.
It's like a helicopter pole you can hold with one hand that turns you into like a fucking demented Mary Poppins. The sound design is this fucking incredible mix of like demented, like breakbeat kind of club music and definitely open source sounds. Like a lot of the guns, this should sound like a criticism, but it's not. A lot of the guns just sort of go bah. And there's a noise for when there's some maps that are like a maze of doors you can open. And there's two different door sound effects in the game. One of them normal, and one of them sounds like a seal going, ah! It's fucking... So the sound of two people fighting in one of those maps is like, ah, ah, bleh, ah, ah, ah. It's fucking...
There's no reason to play another game, to be honest. Everything else we've talked about so far in the pod has been build up to Straftat, the only game anyone should be thinking about right now.
I feel like the other game that it's... So, obviously, you know, as given how many times I've mentioned him, Paul and I play a lot of games together.
Hi.
And I would say that our gaming habit falls into one of two categories. There are games that are like the equivalent of a round of golf, if we were dickheads. I'm going to get fucking beaten to death at golf course for saying that. Which is like going for a walk with your friend. The game is there to occupy you while you chat, right? Like Hunt Showdown, perfect example of this. We've talked very much about life and Pale Tides while playing Hunt Showdown. Warzone, Battle Royales generally are good for that. And then there are the games where you're too busy like hyperventilating from excitement to have a conversation. And I think for us previously that was Mordhau was the closest to that.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, or making like visceral noises, like shrieking and whooping and so on.
I think they have a similar ebb and flow, and I think that's what these games nail, where it's that sense that, like, intense violence is the point, but also there's this kind of glorious moment where you're facing off against each other with unfathomably stupid weapons and sort of ready to sort of clash. And both of these games manage, like, Strafftat. Judoro's not in this conversation. Strafftat does a sort of wonderful version of this where it does have melee weapons, like you said, and they always have build up. You know, you press the button and you pull back and then you strike, and the timing is always absolutely bananas. And some of the weapons, as you discovered today, have hidden mechanics, which we didn't know about, where you can do a charge or something like that we didn't know. And it's wonderful. It's truly wonderful.
We had a round earlier, which I'm so glad it ended the way it did for you, where there's a map, because there's often like a sense of humor to what bunches of guns spawn together. So there's like a map, which I think is a COD map. And there's the variant of it that I think we've hit twice, where all you get is a stupid boop gun that just applies knockback, a taser that paralyzes people, melee weapons, and claymore mines. And you placed a claymore mine in a doorway and then equipped a boop gun in both hands and were just desperately trying to boop me into the claymore for like 4 minutes.
For so long.
As I ran around trying not to get booped, trying to find a gun or another weapon to deal with it. And then eventually I ended up placing my own claymore and getting my own boop gun and trying to get you into the mine. And then eventually you got me into it. And the noise we made probably set off my neighbor's dog. Like, it was...
It's like first person spelunky, the sort of way that the different physics objects interact with each other. Oh, it's just wonderful.
I do also think there's like dueling is such an underrated form of multiplayer, honestly.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And it's Chivalry 2, I think, is, you know, and Mordhau as well. Like, those games are great because they have a very high skill ceiling, but also you can go and hit people in the back and chop their heads off from behind, and it means that you can still have fun by being a backstabbing loon. It sounds really good. I can't wait to have a play around with it. It's interesting that, like, clearly games that are being made by people who, like, really loved the kind of bonkers FPS, multiplayer FPSs from, you know, back in the day, like your Unreal tournaments, etc. Like, there's been a few of those that have tried to get off the ground and have ended quite badly, right? So there was, like, Lawbreakers, and I know Slipgate 2's coming out or has come out, so that one's kind of survived. But there's also Hyenas, which I know was more of a kind of hero shooter as well. But, like, I do think, like, it's hard for those games to survive as kind of AAA experiences, right? Because they have to go up against the kind of solved meta of your Call of Duties and your Overwatches. But it does seem like this sounds like it's kind of speaking a bit more to that experience of flying around in zero G or whatever, being bonkers.
It's a weird mix of being like incredibly generous with its offering, because literally hundreds of maps, and like it's free and you could probably play it for hours and hours and hours just in the free version. I bought the £5 version almost immediately because it's like, fucking hell, I want to give these people some money. And also that offering is incredibly generous. Like, only one of your, only the person you play with needs to own the DLC. And then, like, they put loads of time into making the ugliest hats and characters and costumes you have ever seen. They're incredible. And it's so intentional and so kind of generous in its features. But also it has this big, like, fuck it energy. It pulls off a trick which very few games pull off of... It doesn't come across like it cares. You know what I mean? And like, and I don't mean that in a bad way. It's not that it hasn't been made with a huge amount of love, but it has this sort of vibe of like, fuck it, this doesn't matter. Like, both in terms of like, does this need to look or sound great if it feels great? No. Does it matter if you win or lose when you're playing that many maps that quickly with one other person? Also, no. You know?
Like, yeah. It's very streamlined.
Instinct, I think, is something that has kind of come up a little bit in recent years and is very, very welcome. Like, I've played a bit of Lethal Company with you guys and had an absolute whale of a time doing it, right? Mm. And again, that is a game, and you're, what's the other game which kind of similar, which I've also enjoyed too, the one where you're filming...
Phasmophobia?
No, it's the one where you're going and filming monsters down in a basement, and you're trying to get, yes, like... YouTube streams, basically.
I haven't played it, but I know the one you mean. Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah, it's very good. It's very fun. It's very, very similar to Lethal Company. But again, like, games that are really happy to embrace. It's not just, like, jank. It's more a kind of attitudinal thing of, like, of kind of trusting you that your audience can, like, enjoy something which is, you know, not, like, thematically cohesive, but actually is an invitation for players to kind of create something themselves, right? Without it being like literally a sandbox. I think there's something, you know, there's something exciting about that. And there's been quite a few games over the past couple of years that I think have leaned into that.
Well, I don't think it's an accident that a lot of those games originate either directly or kind of spiritually in the sorts of things that happen in Roblox. And I haven't really made that comparison till just now. I think the best way I could explain Straftat is it's like, it's Roblox for late millennials. Like,
oh Lord!
It transports us back to the point where we were feral 12-year-olds, and will turn you in to a feral 12-year-old.
You might even start an Alien versus Predator fan site, like both of us did when we were young.
Crucially, different Alien versus Predator fan sites.
Yeah,
we didn't know one another at the time.
It's true. This is something I don't have an answer for, but the idea just popped into my head. It is interesting when talking about, we've previously talked about Judero, which also is a very ugly game, but like intentionally, it's kind of intriguing to see why, for me at least, Judero didn't land, whereas this does land. And I assume the answer is purely nostalgic. You know, this is ugly in a kind of Kingpin came out in the year 2000 or whatever and was minging to look at, but we didn't know that at the time. I don't know, there's definitely something about sort of ugly games played through the lens of nostalgia landing, whereas something completely unique not landing. This is a ill-formed thought, to be honest, but I'd be intrigued to see what people think about it.
I feel like, yeah, I haven't played Judero, so I can't make that comparison. I think an interesting comparison to make is Straftat, which I think is both very intentionally ugly as a kind of artistic choice, and also as a sort of thing of like, this doesn't fucking matter, you're here for the deathmatch. Playing as this weird little squash-faced goblin man with a cigarette hanging out the corner of his mouth is more appropriate than just being a stick man, so you deal with it. And something like the state of a modern Call of Duty store, which is full of the most... Obviously, they're technically very accomplished, but incredibly garish, incredibly like off-putting a lot of the time. Designs like you and I, Paul, used to browse the Warzone store just to see what latest like airbrushed side of a van vape store monstrosity had been added, and like that's obviously one of the most expensive games in the world. So like there was a joy in that ugliness as well, but it was of a different sort. It was like, I can't believe this is real, you know.
Sort of far less artistic merit, despite being far more expensive, which is a kind of wonderful thing.
And it's funny to think about how it occurs to me that, like, the game, like, getting over it with Bennett Foddy, like, how, like, weirdly influential that game has been on, like, indie game design. Like, the fact that that game is kind of a comment on... you know, it kind of purports to be a kind of remake. Well, it is a remake of a kind of B game that was kind of thrown together from assets, right? And it kind of leans into that aesthetic. And then you see the kind of, like, what the dude looks like in that game. That has been, like, repeated. And I saw you guys streaming that mad game where you're chained together and trying to escape from hell, you know, which again has, like, Bennett Foddy getting over it kind of DNA to it as well. And it's funny to see that, like, people have obviously kind of embraced the idea of, like, Unity store assets being used ironically or to a kind of a purpose where you're sort of going for, you know, your guys looking like kind of weird homunculus faced dummy guys, you know, rather than anything approaching realistic.
It kind of this is a weird comparison, but I think it holds some ground there. It actually kind of mirrors the way TikTok works. This kind of newer generation approach to social media where authenticity is massively appreciated. So to explain what I'm talking about here, TikToks that do well tend to look like garbage. They're usually filmed quite badly and roughly, and people appreciate that kind of sense of self. You know, it's not overproduced, it's cheap, and people kind of like that. And I think the Roblox comparison you made before, Chris, is like 100% accurate. This kind of thrown together asset store approach to gaming has become massive over the last sort of 5 years, I would say. And people kind of love the cheapness because it feels authentic. It feels like some developer who doesn't have any money just grabbing stuff from wherever for the love of the game, basically trying to put together the game they've always wanted to make. And I kind of vibe with it, to be honest. Like, I like that too. Like, Chained Together is sort of a horrible looking game, but also it kind of works. Like, the more we played it, the more I was like, actually, like, the vibe of this game is great. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah.
It's funny, I'm remembering that game, by the way, that I was trying to think of is called A Content Warning, where you kind of you go down in a lift into a kind of dark factory and you're trying to video things. And the session, I've only played a couple of sessions of it, but one of them I spawned into a game with randos, and it was me and I think two or three like British teenage girls, right? Which is a weird group to be a 38-year-old guy in, right? And they were kind of very, very Generation Z or whatever. And they were all kind of... it was a really interesting experience, actually. It was really fun because they were hilarious. They were really, really funny. They were talking like nine to the dozen and like firing. I felt like 3,000 years old. I felt like so old. And they were just sort of, you know, talking in this kind of complete like mad, you know, patois to each other. And it was just kind of, I don't know, it was really interesting to be alongside for kind of a game that's clearly kind of made for that kind of generation. It was kind of weirdly inspiring, I found, actually. I've always found teenagers, it's hard to say without sounding creepy, but I've always found teenagers quite inspiring figures. Like, there's something about the kind of energy of that, and I think these games kind of capture that a little bit. Maybe my one tin of cider is now kicking in.
I think that's a perfectly salient point to make when you wrote Skins, Jamie. I think that's like...
yeah. Teenagers, they're cool.
And terrifying. But yes, if you want to feel like a teenager and you were born between the years of 1981 and, let's say, 1992, Straftat.
Straftat.
What if I join you saying it? Am I having a go?
Yes, please. Straftat.
Ask your doctor about Straftat.
Makel's anal leakage. Speaking of anal leakage, Paul, do you want to tell us about Cod Blops 6?
Oh, God, I do. I just wanted to insert a little note here that Call of Duty Black Ops 2... Six? What's Black it called? Ops. Black Ops 2-6. 6. Black Ops 26. No, Black Ops 6 is the most demented Call of Duty game I've played in a long time. I actually sent Chris a video of me fighting a demon dog to explain to him why he needed to get this game. Yeah, I don't want to touch on it for too long, but as a sort of brief aside, the campaign is phenomenal. It does away with kind of most of the seriousness that is associated with Call of Duty games these days. It's not a milsim game for the most part. It mostly feels like sort of Titanfall 2 by way of Fear and Doom and a little bit of like Project IGI. I'm just throwing out game references here, but like it's wild. Every level has a completely different vibe. There's some quite robust stealth levels in there. There's big open levels where you drive around in a Jeep and there's multiple optional objectives. There's a really good heist mission where you play as different characters that culminates in a big firefight. And then also there's just some weirdly good horror missions which feel like they're straight out of the game Fear. It's bananas, and I just wanted to recommend it because Call of Duty games can be quite rote, but this one really grabbed me, and actually... I think it has the best campaign I've played in one of those games in a long time. So that's my rant on Black Ops.
It's got Bill Clinton in it.
It does. It does. And in the level where you meet him, you do a stealth and then you take some photos and then you ride out of that room on motorbikes firing at cars and drive and it's glorious.
I played kind of maybe half of it, and it is a masterclass in building a game entirely from cliches and that not mattering in the slightest.
Yes.
It's very demented. It's very it's very comforting. I've got no idea what's happening at any point in there. And yeah, everyone just speaks in like what teenagers imagine army men do. But it's in no way like thin or insubstantial. It's like, it's actually quite an immersive experience. And I was, you know, I found it excellent fun, what I played through. Yeah, it's good.
Have you got to the horror mission yet? Sorry, Chris.
I haven't got to the horror mission yet. I think that's next. I'm very excited to play the horror mission.
I like several things about this. One is that we began this podcast discussing the artistic merits of the you know, lavish dramatic production that is Still Wakes the Deep. And we've managed to like trace the journey all the way to like beating Bill Clinton. Which I mean actually it's interesting to note that like that means is we're kind of that's the second major pop culture object of 2024 that has involved a Bill Clinton jump scare. The other being the movie Long Legs. Inexplicable. But I think in doing so we've kind of captured something of the full span of this storied medium. what could you do in a video game? Fall off an oil rig, meet Bill Clinton. That's
yeah. And Straft Hat. Don't forget Straft Hat.
Yeah.
You can Straft Hat.
You can do both. You can do both.
Okay, yeah.
Do you know what I did? In that game, when I saw that I was in the room with Bill Clinton during his senatorial years before he ran for president, I just walked over to the stage and just stood there watching him. I just stood there for ages. Like, you can't do that in real life. You can't stare at Bill Clinton for 5 minutes without stopping. So I just stood there. I just took him in all of his glory and just, you know, took a moment.
Just took him in.
Took him in. Yeah. They can't stop me from doing
does
that.
Does he play himself?
Bill Clinton as Bill Clinton.
I mean, honest to God, weird. Like, Nicki Minaj is in COD, all right? Like, the point where you can't jump out of the Warzone plane with, like, Nicki Minaj, Bill Clinton, and, like, Ghostface from Scream is the day that we know that they've finally discovered restraint.
That's a good point. I don't know if there's a Bill Clinton skin in Warzone, but if there is, I'll be Nicki Minaj, because why would I ever change?
He got cross when they did that movie Contact. Like, that movie has, like, him in it using, like, Robert Zemeckis using, like, 90s CGI to, like, put him in the movie. And I think, understandably, really, he kind of said, hey, I didn't agree to this. Like, I can't be negotiating with aliens in your movie. So I think... apparently that's not a problem anymore. You can just put dead people in your movies. So who cares?
Bill Clinton isn't dead.
No, he's not. I mean, he should be.
And on that note, well, that is all of the pod we've got time for this evening. Thank you so much, Paul, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I just spoke over you.
You're so good at this.
I'm so good at this.
At least as good as us. And we've been doing this for like 11 years, which is fucking terrifying. If you would like to find more episodes like this one, you can find them on our website at creightonkrowbar.com, which is also where you'll find a link for our lovely Discord community. You can also find these episodes on YouTube, youtube.com/creightonkrowbar. And if you would like, there is actually a way to provide us with money that doesn't involve finding Paul or Jamie in the street and giving them a crisp tenner. They call it Patreon. And you can find out more about supporting the podcast at patreon.com/creightonkrowbar. Thank you so much to everybody that does so. You've enabled this, and I hope you're proud of yourself. Oh, do you know what we could do? In tribute to the Great Migration the last couple of weeks, we could give out our Blue Sky handles. Party like it's 2014. People still use stuff. I'm on Blue Sky now, I guess. I'm never going to post, but I am there.
What a commendation. I can't wait to follow you.
Indeed. You already do, Jamie.
Oh, fuck.
I think it's cjpt.bluesky.social or something like that. Anyway, good night.
I am matronboy.bisky.social. Follow me.
And I am a big bat.bisky.social.
How does one pronounce bisky?
Bisky. Bisky. You know, bisky.
Bisky.social.
There's a raging debate about what we should call the posts we make on Blue Sky, and all of them are awful.
Why not posts?
All right.
Yeah, that's cool. Thanks for having me. I love you.
And I love you, Paul.
Jamie?
I'm just comfortable in my own little world, but I do love you both.
Aw, I love you guys. And I love you, our listeners. We need to stop this. I'm going to make the door noise until this ends.
Stop that.